lights are shining bright, I feel so high. New York City, you look brand new. I can see you from a new point of view, yeah. I can see you from a new point of view. Hang-ups used to bring me down. A twist of fate turned it all around.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff. This week on the show, we have a lot of stuff to talk about, guys, because a couple of new video games came out.
Yes, yeah, you've been playing Dragon Quest a little bit, and then Spider-Man happened. We've both been playing Spider-Man obsessively. You apparently more obsessively than I.
Yes, so on this episode, we are going to be talking first impressions, so spoiler-free. Nothing that we would consider a spoiler, nothing that you wouldn't see outside of, like, the previews, the E3 demo, that sort of thing. Although, I'm not to the E3 demo from this year. You're probably not to the E3 demo from this year.
No, yes. Apparently that raft sequence is way later in the story than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, so we're not spoiling that either. But anyway, so nothing from that sort of thing. But for both Spider-Man on the PS4, Dragon Quest XI on the PS4, two big game launches this week. I've been playing both of them. You've been playing one of them. You also have more thoughts for us on Yakuza Kiwami 2.
Yep. A game I have technically finished, although there is a whole side Majima story that I have not had time to touch. I squeaked in and finished Yakuza Kiwami 2's main campaign the day that Spider-Man came out before it got to my house.
Yes.
I barely made it.
Good job. I did not finish Dragon Quest XI in the 72 hours I had before between me getting that game and me getting Spider-Man. So, yeah. This is an exciting week, guys, because I honestly think these are the two best major game releases of 2018 so far, Dragon Quest XI and Spider-Man. I can say that pretty definitively with Spider-Man because I'm very far into it. Dragon Quest, I've played at least 12 hours of, but that's like maybe 10% of the game, so, right. You know. Thoughts could change there, but I think they will only change for the positive. I am so excited to talk about both of these games. I'm so excited to keep playing them. I'm excited for next week when we go into full spoiler detail on Spider-Man, which is kind of our custom now, do a first impressions thing, then come back and do a fuller review. So I'm very excited to talk about these games. We're also going to be touching on a couple pieces of news, and that'll be today's episode. And if you're wondering, hey, you guys reviewed Spider-Man 1 last week from 2002, then you reviewed Spider-Man 2. Where's the Spider-Man 3 review? Don't worry, we're recording that tonight, too. It's just not going to be in this episode, because I think it would be too much for one episode. So that'll be coming either later this week, or if I'm looking at the calendar and I think we're going to need a rainy day episode, I might hold it, but I think it's going to be coming this week as well. And we'll just give you two podcasts for the price of one. Why not?
Yeah. It's a whole lot of Spider-Man.
It is. I would say it's too much Spider-Man, except I'm having so much fun with all this Spider-Man shit.
Yes, there's never too much Spider-Man. That's what I've learned.
Like, Sean, I'm probably gonna have to, like, ask you to, like, borrow some of those comic files, because I've never read Spider-Man comics, and now I'm like, I gotta read at least some Spider-Man comics, because I'm having too much fun just being in the world of Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm. No, yes, it's finally the bug has bitten you. It's, yes. I have been living this life for forever, since, like, I was, like, 8 or something, so welcome to the fold.
I know. There is a very, very good comic book shop here in Iowa City that has, like, you know, boxes to the ceiling of old comic books, and if you want to find something, that's probably, like, you're not going to find everything there, but if one shop could have it, it's going to be that shop. So if I wanted to go crazy and lose all my money and worldly possessions, I could get into it that way, too.
Yeah, or you could just, you know, get Marvel Unlimited or something and just read comic books that way, because holy shit, comic books are expensive.
My copy of Spider-Man on PS4 came with a month free of Marvel Unlimited, which is awesome.
Yeah, I was really surprised and delighted to see that, because it is, now that I've used it a little bit, it's such a good service that's good that they just give that to you. That's cool.
It's very rare these days you open up a video game and A, have anything inside other than the disc, and B, have anything inside other than the disc that's actually worth holding on to, you know? So I was like, hey, I'm going to use this code. This is cool. So very excited to maybe read some comic books. Very excited to talk about all sorts of Spider-Man with you today. I guess let's go really quick. I said I think these are maybe the two best games of the year. Sean, your quick 5-second reaction to Spider-Man on the PS4?
I think right now Marvel's Spider-Man is my favorite game of the year. I'm according to the in-game percentage thing, I am 50% of the way through the game, which is not, that's not like story stuff. That's just like everything done 50% of the way through. And yeah, I am having such an unbelievably good time with it. I basically agree with what you've been saying of it's utterly superlative in kind of every single way you can imagine. And then on top of that, it's Spider-Man. And so it's just like, it's maybe the single most impressive adaptation of a character to a game I've ever seen. Like, yeah. I think it surpasses even what Rocksteady did with Batman and the Arkham games, which obviously we love those games on this podcast, but this feels like it takes it to a whole other level in how, like, holistic the representation of Peter Parker in Spider-Man is in the game. It's a much fuller depiction of that character than what Rocksteady does with Batman, which is a more very focused thing. And I cannot stop thinking about Spider-Man. Ever since I started playing that game, it's just in my head fucking constantly.
I have been inhaling this game. I am 68% of the way through, so over two-thirds. And again, this is like 68% to platinum, not through the story.
Yeah.
Because I assume this is kind of like the Batman games. Once you hit that 100, you've done pretty much everything there is to do. I cannot stop playing it. I mean, it did come out on a weekend, so it's not like I've been slacking off other responsibilities or anything. A little bit. I have some Freud I'm supposed to read, and I'm sorry, Spider-Man comes first.
That's how the dice rolls sometimes. I was supposed to read some of Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, and I read some of it, but then Spider-Man happened. So I was like, well, yeah. I can read that later.
Let's be honest, Sean. Would you learn more about the human condition reading Freud or playing Marvel's Spider-Man on the PS4?
Playing Marvel's Spider-Man on the PlayStation 4.
Yes.
Easily.
So for all you kids out there,
and I'm not dissing Siggy when I say that. I love some fucking Freud. You know, he's my guy as far as it comes to psychoanalysis. But it's, hey, you know, Spider-Man all day long.
You say this is the best adaptation of a character to a video game. Wait until we get Insomniac's Sigmund Freud in 2020.
Yes, it'll be, you know, a high-octane open-world action-adventure game starring Sigmund Freud. And I don't know. Actually, you could do that. He'd just, like, travel into people's dreams and there'd be giant penises and stuff. It'd be great.
His phallus buster attack is so cool. The animation for it.
Yeah, all of his different unlockable suits, I think, would be really exciting.
All right. Let's go ahead and move on. Sean, my stuff this week is video games. I don't really have anything else. Is your
same
stuff
with me. Yes, okay. 100% me. I have just been in an utterly irresponsible amount of time over the past week playing, just only playing video games.
Same here, buddy. Same here. It's okay. It's, you know, it's actually been a while since I played video games heavily, because over the summer, I played Octopath Traveler, and then I fell off, and it's been, like, at least a month since I really sat down and played a video game, so I'm happy to be back in the zone. So we're going to skip the stuff for now. We'll get to that. I'll talk about Dragon Quest, you'll talk about Yakuza, and then we'll talk about Spider-Man together. Let's do two quick pieces of news. Do you want to do the infuriating piece of news first, or the awesome piece of news first?
Let's do awesome, then infuriating, and then we can go back up to awesome.
I think that sounds good. All right, awesome piece of news first. Doctor Who, our favorite TV show, returns to televisions worldwide on Sunday, October 7th, the day before my birthday. It is moving to Sundays instead of Saturdays this year. Doctor Who has been airing on Saturdays in the UK and now the US since the year 2005, ever since it returned to televisions with Christopher Eccleston. So this is kind of a big change, moving to Sundays. In the United States, there will be a global premiere on BBC America, with the premiere airing simultaneously with the UK. So for us, that's going to be early afternoon. For the UK, I assume that'll be early evening. And I know other countries are getting this too. I didn't look up all of them. Australia usually gets a simulcast, so I know we have some Australian listeners. So it seems like everybody is going to get to watch the premiere on October 7th. The premiere is titled The Woman Who Fell to Earth. Outstanding David Bowie reference there. I am thumbs up on that title for the premiere. And it tickles me that this is coming out the day before my birthday, and our first podcast with Jodie Whittaker as the Doctor will be coming out on my 26th birthday, and I could not ask for a better present than that, so I'm happy.
There you go. It's Doctor Who and our birthdays. It's fate intertwined. It's very disconcerting. I'm super excited. I don't think there's like a huge amount to talk about with this other than fucking, yeah, Doctor Who's finally coming back and we need to look at our schedules and figure out how we're going to time watching the episodes and when we're going to record and everything, but...
We are going to be pirating the shit out of them this year to watch them on the UK schedule. That's what we're going to be doing. I'm just going to say it. If people wonder how are we, like, talking about Doctor Who while it's air, that's how, because there's no way we could get this out on Mondays if we waited until Sunday night.
Yeah.
So, I hope I don't get in trouble for that, but, you know.
You know, we spend so much money on Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I've got to give them their money when the time comes. But yeah, we have a fucking podcast to record.
Yes, they can see my Doctor Who physical media collection, which got so large that I have now had to transfer it into a DVD binder because I didn't have room for all the boxes. So I think I don't feel that bad. I think it's okay.
Yeah,
but yes, that's what we will be doing, Sean. And Sundays are going to be Doctor Who Day in more ways than one.
Yes, it's so, everything's coming together.
It's a 10-episode run, so it should be going 4 weeks in October, 4 in November, 2 in December. So it's going to kind of get in under the wire before the end of the year, if they take no weeks off, which they don't usually, although running through Thanksgiving, that's an American holiday. Never mind. I don't know.
Maybe they'll just be courteous to the American listeners and be like, we'll give you this one, too. Actually, no, that would be, they should just do a Thanksgiving episode special and have Jodie Whittaker come over to America and have another America episode. We haven't done that in a while.
They should have her go back in time and encounter the settlers and teach them the meaning of love and have them not kill all the Indians.
And just utterly change the course of all of human history. I mean, it would be for the better. But it'd be, you'd definitely be sort of like bending the web of time on that one, I think.
What if the 13th Doctor just woke up and she's like, fuck it, I don't care about the rules anymore. I'm going to change. She just makes a list like, let's kill Hitler. We thought we were going to do that once. We didn't do it. We're going to do it this time. All right?
Let's kill Hitler 2. Great episode title.
Yes. All right.
No, it would be Let's Kill Hitler, Here We Go Again.
This is going to derail the episode.
Yeah.
Does Meryl Streep get to guest star in that episode?
I mean, yeah, of course. It's the first Doctor Who musical episode. I think they'll be very excited. It's all ABBA music, of course, but...
Does Meryl Streep play Hitler in this scenario?
No, Meryl Streep plays her character from Mamma Mia, who becomes a one-episode-long companion, basically. You know, she gets wrapped up into the TARDIS, yeah.
Sounds good. I'd be down for this, you know.
Yes, I have not seen Mamma Mia. We have expended everything I know about Mamma Mia by saying Meryl Streep, ABBA, and Here We Go Again.
Okay. It is, I do think, like, I have not seen the new Mamma Mia, because, you know, but I do appreciate that movie so much because it's given us a new, like, landmark sequel title, because you can put Here We Go Again after any movie title, and it's funny, and it's great.
It's the squeakquel of 2018.
It really is. We've been relying on the squeakquel for too long.
Yes, so. It's the dawn of a new era.
All right. So that is the awesome news. We're getting more Doctor Who. The stupid news, the infuriating news, you guys might have forgotten because it's very weird that this is even happening, but Netflix is making a Witcher series. They have bought the rights to the Witcher books. I don't know if that includes any, like, game-specific stuff. I would assume not. But in any case, they have rights to the Witcher universe in some form, and they're making a Witcher TV series, and it's getting close to shooting, and they have just announced who they have cast as Geralt. And in maybe the worst piece of casting I have ever heard of, this is like George Clooney as Batman levels of, what the fuck are you doing? Henry Cavill has been cast as Geralt. Henry Cavill as Geralt. Henry Cavill.
Superman.
Why?
As Geralt.
What? Why? What about Henry Cavill? What about looking at Henry Cavill would make you think he's perfect to play that gruff, older, wizened, just angry monster hunter who hates the world and is just beaten down by life, doesn't have a lot to go for anymore, pretty boy, wet blanket, Henry Cavill. Could this casting be worse?
I mean, at least he's, like, big and strong, so it's like they didn't cast, like, a 15-year-old child to play Geralt. Like, it could be worse if you expand the realm of possibility to the point of ludicrousness. But yeah, it's weird. It's a... I'm with you in that it's very hard for me to see the, like, gruff, world-wearied, super, like, hyper-cynical character that Geralt is in Henry Cavill. The one thing that would be amazing, and, like, still bad about this, but kind of amazing, is I don't know if you've ever seen, like, Henry Cavill actually use his natural British accent, but he has the nerdiest fucking British accent in the world, and the contrast between big, super strong Superman-looking dude and just the most fucking, just elitist, upper-crust, like, lilty, like, kind of, like, nerdy British voice. You know, he doesn't have, like, a good, tough, strong British accent. It's very upper-crust British accent, and if he brings that to Geralt, that would be fucking hilarious to me, because it would be the perfectly wrong accent, but I feel like there would be no reason to make him strictly American if you're doing the Netflix show.
Yeah, there's never a reason to make these characters strictly American, but they always 100% of the time do it, so
yeah.
He will be strictly American. I just, it's bad. It clearly, if anybody involved in this show has cracked open one of the Witcher books, or, I don't know, seen the cover of one of the Witcher games, I would be profoundly surprised. This is clearly a case where they bought this property because they wanted to make their Game of Thrones, and they said, what is a property that is vaguely Game of Thrones-esque, and by Game of Thrones-esque, fantasy that's kind of dark? And someone said, oh, have you heard about this game, The Witcher? And that's it. They bought it, and they're like, do we want to, like, read the books and see if we want to use any of that? No. We're going to use none of that. We're going to do a Game of Thrones ripoff. We're going to cast a guy who looks vaguely like the dude from Game of Thrones, Nikolai Coster-Waldau, and we're going to do that. And we're going to make Game of Thrones, but it's going to be called The Witcher, and it's going to have nothing to do with it. Like, this piece of casting could not confirm that anymore if they tried. It could not. If they cast Meryl Streep as Geralt, that would genuinely be better casting, because she can act.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like Henry Cavill. I've defended him at times. He, I think, when used right, can be effective. You know, if you put him in Mission Impossible Fallout and have Tom Cruise punch him, that's great. He has an extremely punchable face. You know, he's a good, like, douchebag villain. He's not a good Superman. I don't know if he was a good man from Uncle, because I didn't see that movie, because nobody saw that movie. He's not a particularly bankable star, so I don't really get that as a choice from Netflix, because you could have gotten... What you should get is, like, a Eastern European actor or something who is kind of vaguely unknown. Or, I mean, who would be perfect is Mads Mikkelsen. You would get Mads Mikkelsen, and you would have him play Geralt, and that would be perfect in every single way, but they're not going to do that. So, I don't know. This is stupid.
Yeah, it's stupid, but it also... I could not give less of a fuck about a Netflix Witcher show, you know? Like,
yeah.
We talked about it a little bit before we started recording, but every time I think about the fact that show exists, which is very rarely, I'm just confused by it. And it's like, well, I guess that's a thing that's happening. That's fine. Okay.
Yeah, I just, again, if they had cast someone like, I said Mads Mikkelsen because just off the top of my head, that sounded good. But someone interesting who felt like they fit the part, I would be vaguely curious, because I think there's plenty of room to make a great Witcher series.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I think a Witcher television series is actually a supernatural fit if you wanted to actually do the material. And if you were actually doing the material, I also think it could be a pretty solid hit in the way Game of Thrones did its material and did it faithfully and made a good show from the the ground up and became a hit organically from the ground up. I have no sense that they're going to try that with this. It sounds like, you know, studio-mandated casting from people smoking cigars in the top of a, you know, New York penthouse who've never heard of this series. And they're like, who's hot right now? Get that Henry Cavill guy. We want it. Like, he'll keep the mustache. We're not going to CGI it out.
Damn it, you hit the mustache joke before I was going to hit it.
What was your mustache joke going to be?
I mean, it was basically the same thing. Just some sort of vague joke about, well, he can keep the mustache because it's Geralt and he's unshaven. It had more punch in my head.
All right, that's fine. This is stupid news. That show's going to suck. Let's go ahead and move on. Sean, do you want to take Yakuza Kiwami 2 first and follow up from what you told us last week?
Yes. So, you know, quick recap of last week. I really enjoyed the setup of the story, which is sort of a Eastern Yakuza guys, which is, you know, Kiryu and the Tojo clan versus the West and the Omi alliance. And you have Ryuji Goda over in the West, he's the other dragon. So it's the two dragons of the East and the West of the Yakuza facing off. Great setup. It goes in a bunch of crazy fucking places. Like, the ending of this game is utterly ridiculous in kind of the best ways possible. And so all that stuff is great. I love the sort of modernized Yakuza 6 engine and the way the combat has evolved. I think particularly once you get the later game abilities, the combat is a lot of fun, and it's probably the best combat between this Yakuza 0 and Yakuza Kiwami, which are the other ones I've played. This is the best combat in these games so far for me. And the other stuff is... And I guess the other stuff I just want to talk about, which is mainly what I'll just talk about with on the podcast this time and probably address some of the bigger story stuff at Game of the Year, because this is going to be on my top 10. I think it's just fucking awesome. But some of the shit in this game that is so amazing are the weird little side things and the little bits of humor and just the way that the Yakuza team sort of touches up the world with the quirkiest, most ridiculous shit. And there's just parts of this game that I laughed so hard at, some of the funniest stuff I've ever seen in the game. And maybe the best is there is a whole running minigame. I guess there are two big minigames in the game. And I talked about last time the Cabaret Club minigame, and that one's awesome. It comes from Yakuza 0. The story is a sequel to that game's minigame story from Yakuza 0. And I have finished that, and it does everything you could ever want a sequel to that bizarre storyline to do. And they bring back all these old characters and do all this great goofy shit with it. The other big, like, ongoing minigame that has a whole, like, story associated with it is this thing that is almost like a very light real-time strategy thing where you're kind of have to command units and defend these locations. And the minigame itself is fine. What's special about it is the story around it is you are working with Majima, who is the big, crazy, ridiculous, kind of almost Joker-esque Yakuza character from Yakuza 0, who's the other protagonist from Yakuza 0. He has bought up this whole construction company and named it Majima Construction, and he has taken hold of this, like, plans to renovate this whole area and make this, like nice upper-class kind of Kamurocho apartment section called Kamurocho Hills. And so while he's trying to build that up, a rival company comes in and they hire these other guys to try to destroy all of your equipment. And so the mini game comes in of you hiring people up, kind of leveling them up and doing this light real-time strategy kind of tactics thing to guard your equipment while they kind of come in and try to destroy it. And all the sort of villains or the guys that come to try to break all your shit are played by very old Japanese professional wrestlers. And they are like, they have the guys scanned in, and it's their faces, and it's the vocal performances. And I don't know a lot about Japanese professional wrestling, but like, I just kind of vaguely enough of hearing about it around the edges to kind of recognize some of them enough to where I was like, wait, is that Tenryu guy? Is that that fucking Japanese professional wrestler I saw in like some weird YouTube clip? Oh yeah, 100%, that's that dude. And so you just have all these like old crusty ass fucking Japanese professional wrestlers come in, and as you defeat them, they kind of join your team, and you get all these little scenes with them. And they're just the most amazing characters in the world, because if you've ever seen, or like, you know, professional wrestling, or seen like interviews, particularly with old professional wrestlers, you know that the what happens to them in terms of like their voices and their looks and their kind of personality, they become so grizzled, they become so weird. It's kind of like old boxers, where anyone who has that kind of like really physically, you know, intensive job for that long, they just get these like really interesting sort of like characters to them. And so you have these just super grizzled ass old Japanese dudes that have the most fucked up voices of just like, and you can't understand anything they like. I understand Japanese, I can't understand half the shit they say. And so that leads to maybe, in a weird way, my favorite part of all of Yakuza Kiwami 2 is that you unlock a scene once you get enough of those guys on your team where you all go out and you go to this fancy French restaurant and all have to order food together. And it's like this 10-minute-long fucking skit of Kiryu and these three old weird Japanese professional wrestlers all trying to order from this fancy French menu, and they all start arguing with each other about, like, you can't read this, like, you don't understand anything that's on this menu, you're just a big idiot. And it's like, no, I'm going to order this thing. And it's like, it's the blah, 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 blah. It's like, I can't even understand what you're saying because your voice is all gruff and weird, and they're just all sniping at each other, and it just builds and builds. It has this amazing fucking punchline, and it's just one of the funniest things I've seen this entire year, is this ridiculous skit that just goes on, and it's so funny. And that's the kind of stuff about Yakuza as a series that is maybe my favorite. Like, I think they have really talented storytellers in terms of, like, the serious stories that happen in the sort of the main part of the game, and their character work is fantastic, and all that stuff is great. But it's that weird shit you find around the edges that just makes me dig and dig and dig into every single corner of these games. I spent 50 hours playing Yakuza Kiwami 2 over the past week, which is a...
Holy shit.
Way too much time to play a video game. When I say, like, I barely squeaked into the end to finish it on Friday before Spider-Man showed up at my house, like, I had to fucking cram every single second of free time just playing Yakuza Kiwami 2, because I knew, while you could finish the game probably in, like, 15 hours if all you did was the main story stuff, what makes it the best is if you just try to poke at every single corner of the game, because there are all these incredible sort of, like, diamonds hidden in places you wouldn't think. And if you have to try every mini game. I know how to play Mahjong now. That's a thing I learned by playing Yakuza Kiwami 2, because there's a subquest associated with Mahjong. Eventually, I'm sure... there's going to be, because Shogi is in all of these games and they've never made me play Shogi yet, eventually I'm going to learn how to play Shogi, which is basically Japanese chess, entirely because there's going to be some fucking dumb thing in the Yakuza game that's like, well, I guess I have to learn how to play Shogi now. This is my life. So I'm waiting for that to happen. Yeah, Yakuza Kiwami 2 is awesome. The Yakuza games are amazing. I am so excited for Yakuza 3, the PS4 re-release, to come out. I don't think they've said when it's released, but for the West, but it's already out on the Japanese PlayStation Store. And then also, I still have a whole big thing in Yakuza Kiwami 2 to finish, actually, which I haven't even started, which is they have a whole side quest thing you unlock at the end that where you play as Majima, and it's a sequel to Majima's side of the Yakuza 0 storyline that has Miyuki Swashiro's character from that game makes a returning appearance, I know from a trailer, in that sort of side story. So once I finish Spider-Man, I'm going to have to jump right back into Yakuza and finish that stuff up. But for now, Yakuza Kiwami 2 is awesome. If you haven't played any of the Yakuza games yet, start with Zero and start working your way up. But know there's good stuff ahead of you if you do.
Awesome. So you said you've learned how to play Mahjong playing these games, right?
Yes. Mahjong is basically poker. I have never known that, but it's basically poker.
Well, then you should go see Crazy Rich Asians, and the big movie that's out now, and you can be the one white guy in the theater who knows what's going on during the climactic Mahjong scene with Michelle Yeoh, because it's a phenomenal scene, but it's been, I don't know if you followed the conversation online. There are a lot of people in, like, America who are like, I'm not sure what's going on in the I know it's a really good scene. I don't know how Mahjong is played.
It really helps if you can read Japanese, because a lot of the tiles is like, if you can read like the cardinal directions and numbers and stuff, that helps a lot to understanding. And when I say I know how to play Mahjong, I mean like I understand the rules of Mahjong, right. Not that I am good at Mahjong, right?
Yeah, just like I know how to play poker, but I'm not going to go win money in Vegas.
Exactly, yes.
Yes,
I can. Right. I can play Mahjong competently enough to clear a video game challenge in Mahjong, which is not being good at Mahjong.
Awesome. All right. Well, I am going to talk about the other game I've been playing this week that's not Spider-Man. A game that could not really be more different than Spider-Man, except that it instills a similar level of joy in my heart. It's just not the same kind of sugar-high joy that Spider-Man is. And that is Dragon Quest XI, Echoes of an Elusive Age. It's for the PS4. It's also, they put it out on PC, and I keep forgetting that. But if you have, if you don't have a PS4, but you play games on a PC, it is there too, which is cool. That's I would not have expected that game to come out that way, but I'm glad that it did, because more Dragon Quest is good. Dragon Quest is awesome. We will talk about this game and the Dragon Quest series in a second, but I want to start, Sean, with something only semi-related, which is we need to have a quick chat about this ludicrous tendency in the PS4 generation to take great video game cover art like this and hide it as a reversible cover, and actually show you bad video game cover art like this. And I'm showing it to you right now on camera. But you can go look this up online. And this has been happening a lot. Dragon Quest did this. Spider-Man did this. Two games this week. Dragon Quest Builders did this on the PS4. Doom did this. God of War did this. There's others that I think I'm forgetting. I don't get it. I do not get this did not happen in previous generations. But in this generation, especially for games that are imports, like Dragon Quest, you'll have, like, beautiful hand-drawn art by Akira Toriyama, and they'll be like, no good. We're going to put that on the backside of the cover, and we're going to have an intern Photoshop some assets from the game. Or, like, but it doesn't even have to be Japanese. It can be like Spider-Man, which Spider-Man has the most boring fucking cover art. I thought forever the cover art of Spider-Man was placeholder art, because it just says Spider-Man, and it's just a picture of Spider-Man swinging on a red background. It looks like placeholder art. And then you open the case, and the reverse cover art is this beautiful signed drawing of Spider-Man webbing through New York. What is with this trend, Sean?
Well, like, I think what it is we used to just get bad box art, which was just, like, the standard forever, particularly the Xbox 360 generation. Box art was just fucking bad all the time. Now we have bad box art, but they give you the good box art that, like, marketing assholes don't want you to have, and it's on the inside. So I think it is a net positive, because you used to just be saddled with the bad box art, and you didn't think about it because it was the only choice you had. Now that you have a choice, you realize, fucking most box art is fucking terrible. And I don't know why America, because it is, like, usually Japanese box art is good and European box art is good. Like, it's almost like a
North
meme.
American.
Yeah, it's almost like a meme in video game discussions at some point to just, like, point out. I think, like, maybe the biggest example is if you look up Ico, the PS2 game, you know, the precursor to Shadow of the Colossus. That one is very infamous for having, like, beautiful box art in the Japanese and European markets. And then when they brought it over to America, it's just the, like, lamest fucking, like, mid-2000s CG character bullshit you've ever seen. I don't know what's up with American marketing departments. I don't know if maybe it's up with Americans. I don't know. I am, like, heavily suspicious of marketing in every aspect of my life. And so I just assume that the marketing people are idiots. Because my brother also works in marketing now, and he's a dummy. So they have to all be dummies. But yeah, like,
thing,
that's what it seems like.
Here's the thing to me. The funny part of this is, so the Nintendo Switch is out now. And Nintendo games have traditionally always had good box art. They've never had this problem. Nintendo does its own thing. They generally don't alter the box art for the North American release. And so what's happened is you're starting to get these ports of games onto the Nintendo Switch, right? And when games come to the Nintendo Switch, they just use the good box art. Like Doom, when it came over to the Switch, they just used the good reverse box art. They never used that horrible, like, Doom Marine just dumb pose that's on the main, like, PS4 box art. They just used the good one. When they brought Dragon Quest Builders over to it, they didn't use the bad North American art. They used the actual Akira Toriyama illustration from Japan. I assume when Dragon Quest XI comes to Switch, which is planned someday in the future, they're going to use the real cover art. And Nintendo games sell very well. They sell very well, particularly in physical copies, because people really like there's a culture among that with Nintendo fans. And so there's more of a culture with Nintendo games to try to put your best foot forward on the cover art. And it clearly works for them around the world. So it's a trend that baffles me. The Dragon Quest XI one is particularly infuriating to me right now, because there might be no moment in history in which Akira Toriyama's art is more popular in the United States than it is right now, with a bunch of adults with disposable income watching Dragon Ball Super so much it crashes Crunchyroll on Saturday nights. And you hide the clearest link this game has to that super popular thing so you can make it look generic. I really would love to hear the marketing doublespeak bullshit around this that would explain that, because it is a baffling decision. I mean, no skin off my back. They included the actual cover art. I never have to look at the Photoshopped one, but it's funny to me. I really don't understand this as a trend. And, you know, yes, we definitely did go through a phase, I think, in the 2000s and in the last generation where box art got pretty bad, and I do like having the reverse cover art, but it's not a forever thing. Like, I think video game box art was pretty good up through the, like, PS1 generation and 64 when it was on actual boxes and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It was probably the PS2 Xbox generation where it started getting bad, and even then, like, you know, I think a lot of the big games from that generation, like Halo 2 has really good art, GameCube is different because that's Nintendo. There are a lot of PS2 games with good cover art. So I don't know quite when it happened. It probably was the 360 generation when you had, like, a dominant Western force in the market. But It is a very strange thing in the industry right now.
Yeah, but I appreciate that they give us the choice, that they sneak it in there and be like, hey guys, you want the good box art? We put it in there. I don't know why, because it is always whenever I've seen, you know, on forums and stuff when developers chime in, developers are always like, yeah, no, this is like the box art we wanted to have. And then marketing people came in from the publisher and said, but our tests say that if you have a like gruff male protagonist standing sort of half with his back turned to the cover with dramatic lighting covering half his face, I think that's going to be the thing that really grabs everyone's attention. You're like, the box art that's on every fucking video game for the past 10 years.
Yeah. And I would really love to be in the room for whatever produced that Spider-Man cover art, because this is such a good, distinctive, stylish game. And they gave it the least good, least distinct, least stylish cover I think that could possibly exist.
Yeah, it's like you can... I think there have probably been like a million or more better box arts made by people in the photo mode in the game since the game's released than the box art they actually made.
Yeah, it's weird. Oh well. So Dragon Quest XI, Echoes of an Elusive Age. I fucking love this game. I love this game so much it hurts. And I am glad that I can say 2018 is the year I fell in love with the Dragon Quest series, first with Dragon Quest Builders earlier this year on the Nintendo Switch, and now with the first full mainline game I'm playing in full, Dragon Quest XI, here. It is so good. If you don't know what Dragon Quest is, Dragon Quest is basically the grandfather of all JRPGs, and I mean that both in the sense that it is essentially the original progenitor of the genre as we understand it today. Dragon Quest releases Dragon Warrior over here, predates Final Fantasy. It is basically the birth of that genre as we understand it. But it is also the grandfather of the JRPG in that it is the series that is sitting on its front porch, in its rocking chair, doing its own thing. It does not care what's going on with technology outside. It doesn't care what the kids are into. It is there when you want to come over and hear a good story and just spend some time with a guy who is old and happy and content and wise and wants to share stories with you. And he's probably going to tell those stories very slowly, but he's going to do it with charm and wit. And that is why Dragon Quest is the grandfather of the JRPG. That is how I think of it. And Dragon Quest XI absolutely lives up to that, although it is also technologically superior, and we will talk about that in a second. But yes, Dragon Quest is sort of famous in the West for being that series that people in Japan love to a kind of frightening degree, like to the degree that the famous legend around Dragon Quest goes that like the Japanese government forced them to release the games on a Saturday so there would not be a massive break in worker and student productivity. I don't think that's actually true, but just the fact that it has taken on as a legend should tell you a lot about how beloved this game is in Japan. I think at the current count, Dragon Quest XI has sold 4 million units in Japan, mm-hmm. which is a lot. Japan's not that big, you know? Yeah. So 4 million is a lot. But these games, they've been coming out for a long time. They are Square Enix's other, you know, big JRPG series, more popular in Japan than Final Fantasy. But where Final Fantasy has always been kind of more popular overseas, it's been the big JRPG in the West, in Europe and North America and things like that. Dragon Quest has never made a huge impact over here, and people often ascribe that to it is just very mechanically different than a lot of other JRPGs in that it has stayed what we would call old school or hardcore for a long time. It has not changed its ways as much. I think that popular narrative belies a lot of other truths about the series, which is that it's often been much more narratively adventurous than other games in this kind of genre. It's done a lot of other sort of things that are significant in terms of game design. But yes, it is a JRPG where you have a basic turn-based battle system. They've never done active time battle. They have updated to there's like enemies on the map that you go hit Persona style, but it is so it's not random encounters anymore. But it is still very traditional in that sense. And it is also, I think, significant as kind of one of the only long ongoing series that you can clearly prescribe as sort of an auteurist sort of thing, because it's three main guys who have been in charge of this series for its entire lifespan, which is Yuji Horii, who is the main scenario designer, game designer, all of that. He's like the director of the franchise. Akira Toriyama, the artist and author behind Dragon Ball, who is also the main artist on these games, does all the character designs, does all the box art, all the marketing art, and That's why they look so fucking amazing. And then you have Koichi Sugiyama, who is the composer of the games. And Koichi Sugiyama, Sean, this dude's 87 years old. Did you know that?
Fuck, Jesus Christ. I mean, it makes sense. Because he has, I mean, you said it, but it's, like, deserves reiterating. These three guys have been on every mainline Dragon Quest game since Dragon Quest 1. So yes. It is like...
It's their series.
Yeah, and it's been, that's unprecedented. Like, there is no other... I mean, there are very few franchises ongoing that are as old as Dragon Quest, but there are no others, and there is no, like, long-running franchise that has had the same, like, top-line creative team throughout its entire inception.
Right. Like, the Mario games, you know, Shigeru Miyamoto's name is on every single one of those, and he's had, obviously, a big influence on all of them, but he is not down in the trenches directing Mario games every day. Same with the Zelda series. He's there on kind of an advisory role, but he is not an active designer on those games because he couldn't be. He's too busy, right, to just be making single games. But no, that is Dragon Quest. Like, a lot of other people work on these games, and a lot of other people have come in and out of the door, obviously, but that hand has been very steady and is very recognizable, and I do think is one of the cool things about it, that you start up any Dragon Quest game, 1 through 11, from the early 1980s to now 2018, we're almost into the 2020s, and these three guys, their names are still up there on top. And Dragon Quest XI is the newest one of these. It came out last year in Japan on the PS4 and the 3DS. We just have the PS4 version over here, as well as a PC port, as I was telling you about. They've actually done some pretty cool stuff for the North American release. They've gone back into the game, and they've completely updated things like the graphics, so they look much better and are much more polished. The frame rate is much more stable. The resolution is higher. There are PS4 Pro enhancements if you have a PS4 Pro and a 4K TV. They've added English voice acting, which I turned off as soon as humanly possible because it's terrible, as it's a Square Enix dub and Square Enix is chemically incapable of producing anything resembling a competent English dub. But it is there if you want it. In Japan, it has no voice acting, so if you turn off the English voice acting, there's no voices. That's another thing. Dragon Quest doesn't need your fucking voice acting. It's got its text, it's got its music, it's got its Akira Toriyama character design. That's plenty. Voices would be too much. That would be sensory overload for this series. So, but they've added all of that stuff, so that's nice. But yes, let's talk about the game itself. Dragon Quest XI is... What is the name of the realm in this game? It doesn't say on the box. That makes me sad. Oh, well.
It's Erdrea.
It's Erdrea.
I have Wikipedia up.
Oh, good. Okay, it's the land of Erdrea, and you play as the reincarnation of the Luminary, who may or may not be... I think he might be supposed to be, like, the reincarnation of, like, the original Dragon Quest hero all the way back from the original Dragon Quest. Mm-hmm. He is, like, born from a branch of the Yggdrasil, which is, like, the Tree of Life creation in the Dragon Quest world. And he is being, it opens basically with a Moses story where the Luminary is, like, being hunted by the government or by the king. And so they put him in a little boat and send him down river. And then Grandpa Gohan from Dragon Ball, because it's just Grandpa Gohan from Dragon Ball, finds him and raises him as his own son. And then you play, like, on his 18th birthday as he is becoming an adult and has to climb to the top of this peak with his friend, which is what they do in the town he was raised in. And then an adventure ensues to go save the world from a dark being, because that's generally what you're doing in a game like this, is you're saving the world from a dark being, although there is a lot more narrative latitude within that overall structure than you might think. And, yeah, that's the basic setup for the game, but what I've found playing this and playing Dragon Quest Builders and where I've kind of fucked around with other games in the series is a basic explanation of, like, the plot or the mechanics of these games does no justice to them. You really have to play it to understand the charm, because these games are endlessly charming. I find Dragon Quest XI bewitching to play. It is a beautiful game. I think it's one of the most gorgeous games ever made. I think it is one of the most graphically impressive games on the PlayStation 4. It is a beautiful sounding game. I think Koichi Sugiyama's music is amazing. I think the character designs are amazing. I think the writing is consistently surprising and sharp and witty and emotional and soulful. It is just such a pleasure to be in this world and walk around it and talk to people and look at things and listen to things and engage with the battle system, which is basic in some ways and very, very deep and interesting and complex to engage with in other ways. The overall thought that's kept coming to mind as I play Dragon Quest XI is still waters run deep. You know, this is a game that, and the series as itself, sort of looks still and stable and maybe immobile on the surface, and then you really engage with it and you drill down into it, and there is so much going on there. And I wanted to ask you about that, Sean, because you kind of got on a Dragon Quest kick a little bit last year, didn't you?
Yes, I played Dragon Quest 1 and 2 in their entirety in Japanese, and I got like halfway through Dragon Quest 3 before I was like, I can only spend so much of my life playing emulated Japanese Super Famicom RPGs and before I have to burn out. And so eventually I want to get back to that project. But yeah, I basically agree with everything you said about like describing what you are doing and what the plot is and all that does not communicate anything real about the experience of playing the game. Even going back all the way to Dragon Quest One, I was utterly floored by how much fun I had playing that game in 2017. When it's like, you know, that game is primordial in many ways. Like it is the progenitor of that entire genre, but it still stands like unique and apart from it in many ways. And that is kind of the sense of all of Dragon Quest. Obviously, I only played those first two, but it is that like it has this sort of authorial and aesthetic uniqueness to it that is so set apart from all the rest of JRPGs. And obviously, you know, the DNA of Dragon Quest is in every single JRPG because it is from the beginning, but it has just trucked along on its own path ever since Dragon Quest One, and there's something so incredible about that, and it does have this overall aesthetic kind of cumulative impact that is so much more than the sum of its parts.
Yes, and a lot of what we're saying so far, I think you could apply to any game in the series. You know, throw a dart and pick, like, I don't know, Dragon Quest VI or something, and you would get a lot of this, right? But let's talk about what makes Dragon Quest XI in specific special. I have had two specific theses on this game so far, and they're basically the same thesis, but I'm just going to express them in two different ways. The polite way to say it, or maybe the more, like, put-together way to say it, is that if you've ever wondered what it would be like to play an old-school JRPG, like an older Dragon Quest Final Fantasy kind of game, made in 2018 with 2018 technology and a lot of 2018 visual sensibilities and things like that, Dragon Quest XI is that game. This is not a game that is cutting corners technologically. This game is a full 32-gigabyte install on the PS4. This is not like, you know, Gravity Rush or Persona or one of those games that's that you get on the PS4 that is not really using the power of the system. This is using the power of the system. It is a big, gorgeous, spacious game. It has it's cel-shaded, but the resolution of the textures and everything is still extremely high, so it feels like you have stepped into an Akira Toriyama cartoon, basically. Not, and I don't necessarily mean an anime, I should say. I mean almost more like an Akira Toriyama manga, but with color, because it doesn't quite look like an anime adaptation. It really does look like they took his drawings and made it a video game, and you're out playing in it. It's a very similar sensation to me as Breath of the Wild last year, which is, you know, just absolutely beautiful aesthetic, realized very well with the technology of the day. But this is on the PS4, so it's got a lot more power to work with. It's gorgeous, and, you know, because of that, you have a big world, and you can go around and select the monsters you're going to fight. There's not, you know, random encounters. You can ride a horse. You can go through these enormous towns. This game has the best fucking towns I've ever seen in a video game. I get excited every time I'm about to go into a town and know that I'm going to spend an hour or two just walking around the town and doing the normal things of talking to people and getting quests and checking on my armor and those sorts of things and selling loot, but also just looking at the taverns and looking at the rooms and looking at the furniture and just seeing what little design details are in there, because this is such a holistically complete world they have crafted. It is a joy to look at. So on that level, it is, again, it's like mechanically it is an old school JRPG, but pushed to this incredible level. And the other way you could express this thought that I've expressed it is, Dragon Quest XI is what you would get if Final Fantasy had stayed the course in the 1990s, rather than crawling so far up its own ass you can't even tell where it is anymore.
Yes. Yeah, if they're like, I mean, and it's like kind of what Square Enix has done with its other stuff, like Bravely Default, of like, what if shit was just about the crystals or the Demon King? Like, what if it could just still be that? Because there's still stories to be told that have that big structure, because it allows you to focus on the little things if you have the big, giant quest to beat the Dragon Master or whatever.
Absolutely. And as much as I do love those throwbacks Square has been doing, like Octopath Traveler, Bravely Default, I Am Setsuna, they've been doing a lot of these lately. The difference is Dragon Quest XI is not a throwback. This is what they've been doing the whole time. There wasn't a break, and then they're like, let's make an old-school Dragon Quest game. This is an evolved version of the genre as it existed primordially in the 80s. And that's what I mean about, like, what if Final Fantasy didn't crawl up its own ass? I don't mean what if Final Fantasy stopped innovating, because Final Fantasy has had innovations since the 90s that I think are really cool and really valuable. You know, there are things like the battle system in Final Fantasy X is still extremely influential on the entire genre. Up to and including now, Dragon Quest XI basically borrows a lot of elements of it, and I'm sure other ones in the series have too. So it's not like the series has been worthless. I've liked a lot of Final Fantasy games. I put Final Fantasy XV on my number 2 on my top 10 that year. But I'll tell you this. In the 12 hours I've spent with Dragon Quest XI, I have felt more going through this narrative and meeting these characters and seeing this world than I have in 60 hours with any Final Fantasy game, including and post Final Fantasy VII. Because this game is not about the gimmicks and creating the craziest world you can have and about putting zippers everywhere you can put zippers. It is about having characters and a world and a story and emotions. And I think it is something the genre can get away from when you're trying to kind of run away from what the genre is. And that's not true all the time. Persona, which we love to death, is obviously a beautiful evolution of this entire genre. But I also would say it understands the fundamentals maybe better than a lot of the competition. And Dragon Quest XI is all fundamentals. And so playing it, it really is this joy of just getting all those fundamentals evolved over decades and decades of making these games with just this beautiful artwork, beautiful visuals, those big, vast towns to explore, these amazing characters you meet. And it's all so unassuming. Everything you run into in the game is not trying to wow you the first time anything happens. It's presenting you with a world and a story and characters and letting you get to know them over time. Like, none of these characters are instant hits. There's no characters who you see and you're like, this is my favorite character of all time now. But there's already a couple where I meet this character, and then I spend 5 hours with them, and I realize I kind of am starting to love them like I love a person. It's just so well done on that level. And again, I'm not that far into the game. 12 hours in Dragon Quest XI is fucking nothing. I don't even have the whole party yet. Like, I have enough for a 4-person party in the battle system, but there's 7 characters and I have 5. So I've still got a bit to go before I'm even, you know, rocking the full Dragon Quest XI party. One thing I should note about the overall, like, design of the game that I do think Westerners should know is that if you really have an aversion to MIDI music, you should not be playing Dragon Quest games. Dragon Quest XI is, its music sounds like it was done for the PlayStation 1. The series has not really evolved beyond that. Like, that was kind of the last time they majorly updated the music. So it's got this, like, MIDI synthesized score that sounds pretty old at this point. I love it. I think it's really cool. I think it's very charming. I think it works with the overall aesthetic of the game. I felt nostalgic for it, not because it's the same compositions, but just because it sounded similar to Dragon Quest Builders. And I'm like, oh god, I love that game so much. I want to go play Dragon... No, I'm playing Dragon Quest XI. I can just keep playing this one. but... I have seen, that is one thing that a lot of people, when they pick up this game, they're like, why does the music sound so old and outdated? And I do think it's a choice. Like, there is already a symphonic soundtrack out in Japan that you can, like, download here that is, like, all the music from the game done live with the Tokyo Philharmonic Orchestra, and it sounds gorgeous. So clearly there's not a budget limitation here. I think if they wanted to do a big symphonic soundtrack for Dragon Quest, nobody at Square Enix is going to tell them no. I think it is very clearly an artistic and aesthetic choice, and I like it a lot. I think it's charming. I think it's just so much of what these games are and what this game is. But if that bothers you, like, listen to it on YouTube for a while. If it's going to grate on you, this is not the game for you. There's a lot of ways in which Dragon Quest might not be the game for you. This just is not the kind of game in the genre that has been popular in the West for a long time. And I think that's cool. I love playing it. It is so its own thing. I do think some video game critics, when they get into the mode of, like, why hasn't Dragon Quest evolved yet, it winds up sounding weirdly culturally insensitive of, like, they're basically asking, why aren't Japanese people making games like Americans? And that just becomes an undercurrent of a lot of reviews of this game that I think is kind of weirdly tone deaf. So, but there's a difference between that and just it not being your style or your speed, and I can get that. But I think this is a gorgeous game. I love it. As much as I'm loving Spider-Man, I am so excited to finish Spider-Man and get back into this game because it's amazing. And before I let us move on to Spider-Man, I just want to kind of, like, tie this all together by telling one story that happened in the game so far. Because this is such a quiet, small, unassuming moment, but I think this was my equivalent of the moment for you, Sean, when you did the Bloody Baron quest in Witcher 3, and it's just like the game clicked for you. At least that's how you told it to me back in the day on the podcast. This is not anywhere near as big as that. So this is a minor spoiler. This is something that happens like 3 hours into the game, but again, that's like maybe 3% of the way through the game, so I feel okay spoiling this. So I describe this as like the gentle magic of Dragon Quest storytelling. So at one point, you're going through this area in the game called the Mangle Grove, which is this like forested area that you have to get to. All the names in this game are so great. I should have said the monster design in Dragon Quest XI is, in all the Dragon Quest games, is the fucking best because it's Akira Toriyama doing JRPG monsters. My favorite one is there is a teacup pig in a giant wizard's hat, and it's called a sham hat witch, and you meet it in the Mangle Grove, and it is my new best friend. I love the sham hat witch. And it's also just the best fucking name. Yeah.
Awesome. I mean, it sounds like a sexual position, but great.
Jesus. All right, well, anyway, you're in the Mangle Grove, you're exploring. This game does not directly encourage you, but it's so beautiful, and I just love being in it, that I definitely feel encouraged to just explore kind of every inch of the maps that I'm given. And on one kind of far corner, you happen upon this chest, and you open the chest, and it's empty. And this is the first time it's happened, and you're like, that's weird. Why did they just have a trick chest in this game? That's kind of odd. And you move on, and later you go make camp at this house, and it says this is the woodcutter's house. But conspicuously, there's no woodcutter at the woodcutter's house. There is, however, an adorable dog, and the adorable dog follows you around, and it barks, and it just, like, once you meet the dog, it's just following you, and that's really cool. And you poke around the woodcutter's house, and you find that there's this plant. It's a leaf of the Yggdrasil, the tree. And when you see these in the game, your luminary ability allows you to, like, see beyond your own cognition, and it, like, gives you this flashback to things that happened in the area. And the flashback here around this Yggdrasil branch is you see that the woodcutter was, every day he went out and rebuilt this bridge, and every day a tricky devil, this little monster, came and broke the bridge, and the woodcutter and him are locked in this, like, Sisyphean struggle together, and finally the tricky devil gets mad and transforms the woodcutter into the dog. The dog you've been playing around with is the woodcutter. And you realize that the tricky devil is hiding back in that empty chest you saw earlier. And the only way to proceed is to fix this bridge. And the only way to fix the bridge is to have the woodcutter with you. So you go back to the empty chest, and you find the tricky devil, and you kill the tricky devil, and you restore the woodcutter, and he's very grateful, and he goes and he builds you a bridge. It is just this little slice of story. It's so charming. And while it is all technically required to continue with the game, like this is not an optional side quest or anything, the way it's encountered feels entirely player motivated. It does not feel like there was an icon on the map and you went over to the icon and it says, oh, hey, there's a bridge that's out and there's no woodcutter here. What are we going to do? There's none of that. It's you went around the world and you kind of put things together, and without even knowing it, the game had put all the pieces there for you to continue with the story, feeling like you're just discovering things out on an adventure. And there are better examples of that in the game that I don't want to spoil yet. There is a narrative moment, there's a significant narrative turn that happens around hour 7 that floored me. Just one of the best pieces of storytelling I've ever seen. But this little thing with the woodcutter and the dog, I was just like, this is so charming and unassuming in its execution. I was head over heels at that point. I fucking love this game.
Awesome. Yeah, I feel like I should mention at this point that I have actually tomorrow, I believe, a Japanese copy of Dragon Quest XI is arriving at my house. I've been biding my time because Dragon Quest XI in Japan is fucking expensive, like basically like $90 US, more or less. And then finally, all the talk around Dragon Quest XI coming out of here, and then especially what kind of did it for me that was like, okay, I just have to pull the trigger on this, was I watched a YouTube video. It was just like, I just kind of like want to see some of this game because I hadn't really seen much of it actually being played. And they got into a fight, and they won the fight, and then it went bring, and I'm like, oh shit, it made the fucking Dragon Quest noise. Yep. I need to play this fucking game now. And it only cost me $67 US to order the physical copy of, that's like with shipping, the physical copy of the Japanese game, because if I got the digital version, it would still be about $90 US. So I have the Japanese version of the game coming out. I very specifically have to play the Japanese version because I was watching the obviously the English-American version on YouTube, and they were using all these spells that confused me, like heal. I don't know what heal is. I don't know what that does. Hoimi. That's what, I don't know what heal is. Hoimi is what you do to restore someone's HP. They were using frizz. I don't know what the fuck frizz is. It's Gira. I don't know why they had to change all the goddamn names of the spells. Hoimi is Hoimi. There's no such thing as a heal slime. It's a Hoimi slime, motherfuckers. I needed the Japanese version, so I got it.
Yeah, so just to clarify, you have played the others in Japanese. This is one of the ways you kind of practice and use your Japanese knowledge, so you want to play the original version.
Yes, I look forward to spending 200 hours playing Dragon Quest XI, desperately trying to be able to read everything.
I'm excited, because this means we'll be able to have a full discussion about this game at some point this year, but we'll have these two slightly different perspectives on it, which I think is
good. Yeah, it's been a while since I did a big project of practicing reading Japanese, so I'm looking forward to slaving through that.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, they are doing a patch for the Japanese version to bring in some of the visual enhancements they did for the US version. Maybe I heard that in a dream, and it's not true, but it sounds like it would be. I don't know why they wouldn't do that.
Yeah, it would be weird if they didn't do that. Regardless, I need Hoimi. I can't deal with heal.
Yes,
It just doesn't do it for me.
Clearly, for all the people of the island nation of Japan, the original version was just fine. So I think you'll be okay.
There are 4 million people that very much enjoyed that version of the game.
Yes. And it cannot be stressed enough how much Akira Toriyama just should do the art design for everything. Just everything in the world. Just the video games, the movies, the books, everything. Paintings, wallpapers. He is, I think, one of the best and most significant artists alive on planet Earth. And I love his style to death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
We are well-recorded Toriyama fans on this podcast.
Yes, indeed. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to something else we love passionately, intensely, maybe unhealthily. Spider-Man!
Fucking Marvel Spider-Man, Jonathan.
Spider-Man on PS4 is a fucking masterpiece, at least in what I've seen so far. I am going to start this conversation by just reading a tweet or two I sent about the game the other day, because I think this sums up my thoughts on it better than I could off the cuff, and then I'll let you go. I said, Insomniac Spider-Man is so good in so many ways, including ways I wasn't anticipating. I had high expectations and even higher hopes for this game, and it surpasses every single one of them. This is a big-budget licensed game that feels like nothing less than a true passion project for all involved. And I think that really sums it up for me. I was expecting to think this game was rad. I was very excited for this game. It looked like the Spider-Man game I wanted when I was a kid. And it is that. It is the Spider-Man game I wanted when I was a kid. And then it is so much more than that in the combat and the story and the characterization and the New York they have built and the amount of stuff they have put in there for you to do. This game goes so far above and beyond what I think I could have ever reasonably anticipated, and it feels like such a labor of love by the people who made it, which is not always the case for big budget games in general, because it's hard to keep that love up when making a project this big and involving this many people, but let alone a licensed video game. This does not happen that often. The closest precursor to this is the Batman Arkham games by Rocksteady, and I love those games, and I don't mean to put those games down at all, but this game kind of kicks their asses. It is an amazing accomplishment. I have played an unhealthy amount of it in the last 3 days, and all I want to do is go play more. Sean, your take.
My take, first I want to start with the story of me getting the game, because obviously I didn't just get the game. I talked about this a couple weeks ago on the podcast that I got, when I got my new TV, I decided, oh, fuck it, I got a 4K TV, I might as well go down this, all the way down this rabbit hole. Also, my dad plays video games, but he only has an Xbox, and so I was like, maybe I can just give him my old PS4 and that'll be a cool sort of like early birthday present. So it was like kind of two birds with one stone sort of thing. So I do have, I'm going to show you, Jonathan, my Spider-Man PS4 Pro.
It's so cool.
I'm very happy that this game is fucking amazing, because I spent $400 getting this fucking console. And so if it was a disappointing game, it would be bad to have this very expensive piece of hardware that reminded me of it. Luckily, it's very good. I'm also going to show you, Jonathan, I know this is an audio thing, so the video stuff doesn't work that well, but the box it comes in is fucking awesome looking.
It's a very good, you guys can look this all up while you're listening.
Yeah. But the art on the back is especially fucking rad.
Oh my
god! Spider-Man fighting Mr. Negative.
Why isn't that the back of the normal box? All we've got is the fucking Spider-Man logo on the PS4 box. That makes me sad. That's good art.
It's good art. It's a cool box. Obviously, you can't get it now, so it's no point to talk about it. But if you did get the Spider-Man PS4 Pro, it looks fucking cool. Also, I found it very funny that they still send you the shitty little Sony earbuds in the box.
You mean
that
earbud?
As far as I remember, I don't know what happened to my original pair from 2013, but they seem to be just as shitty as they were then. So you get that. Also, there's a very cool controller. I really like the design of the controller. It's red with white buttons.
That controller is great.
Yeah, it looks really good. In fact, I think the controller might be my favorite part of the whole package, just aesthetically. There's something that's very minimalistic. It's cool.
As someone who has always gotten red controllers as like my controller color of choice, I just love red stuff. That console is kind of my dream console, but I already had a PS4 Pro, so I could not in good conscience justify that expense.
Yes, no, that is more than fair enough. I am not like a big limited edition tech kind of guy. It's just like everything lined up for it to make sense, because also the version of the game comes with the DLC pack, so I have all the DLC ready to go as well, so that's I'm all set. So anyways, that's the preamble to me getting the game and getting the console and all that. I will say that like the one small negative of this whole experience is It took me about an hour to do all the stuff, because I also wanted to switch my 2 terabyte hard drive that's in my old PS4 and put it into the PS4 Pro. And so it's like, you know, this is my most anticipated game since I played Persona 5 in 2016. Like I have talked before on the podcast about just how absurdly excited for this game I was. And so there was sort of this like cruel irony aspect to the whole thing of I finally had the game right in front of me and the console and everything, but it's like I can't really start playing the game until I set all this shit up and transfer all the memory and download all the stuff and get my saves and get all that hooked up and hook up the PS4 for my dad upstairs because I haven't played God of War. It's like, I just want to play Spider-Man. I have to do all this shit. So it's, you know, like a sort of first world problem, but I was feeling it in that first hour that I had the console. But yeah, then once I had everything set up and I started playing the game, I fell in love with it basically instantaneously. It is, I mean, just from, like, literally from the logos. Like, the Insomniac logo, the music that plays, and then the Marvel Comics, like, Marvel Studios logo, the one that plays in front of the movies, they put in front of the game, which I was not expecting. It makes sense, but I just hadn't thought of, like, oh yeah, fuck, of course, that's just, like, the Marvel logo for this kind of stuff. But Marvel just doesn't have any games, so you never see it. And it just, like, did a lot to get me pumped up, and then I loaded into the game, and the first cutscene is awesome, and then just the way, I think, like, the way to start talking about this game is just to talk about that first moment where it goes from the cutscene, and Peter puts on the suit, he sees the bill come under the door, and he sees, like, the kingpin call of, like, well, I either pay my bills or I go take down Wilson Fisk. Guess I'm going to get evicted at some point in this game. And you jump out the window, and then immediately you just start swinging. And it is the smoothest transition from cutscene to gameplay kind of ever. Because this game is so unbelievably gorgeous in every single facet that I am still amazed every time it transitions from a cutscene to gameplay, just because I keep on expecting it to be a pre-rendered cutscene because it looks so fucking good. And then you immediately start playing it and you just, you know, jump out that window, and the little button prompt says it's like, hold R2 to swing, and you just immediately start swinging.
Yeah, I might still say God of War from this year might have the smoothest, given that that's the game is literally just one unbroken take. But especially considering this game has kind of even more intense aesthetic things going on with a lot of it, including, like, you know, more realistic human faces. Like, Peter Parker is not Kratos. He is not a weird Greek god.
Kratos is the Greek god of war.
I can't keep it all together now that they're crossing the fucking mythologies in these games. Anyway, but yes, I love that this game, it knows what you want it to do. You want to swing around as Spider-Man, and it wastes as little time as humanly possible between you saying, start a new game, and you are swinging through New York as Spider-Man, and then you're fighting Wilson Fisk, and you're taking down the Kingpin, and you're sort of being inundated into this brand new Spider-Man lore, because that's one of the fun things Insomniac gets to do here, is this is their own Spider-Man world, and they can do whatever they want. It's a clean slate continuity-wise, and they're like, we're going to pick a character out from here, we're going to pick a character out from here, and we're going to put these characters over here, and we're going to take, you know what, let's say Doc Ock doesn't exist yet, so let's take Dr. Octavius, and we'll put him over here, and we'll save that for later, and we'll just, like, put all these pieces on the board. And so there's also just this sense of, like, liberation and joy in the overall continuity they're getting to make. Like, as a comparison to Batman, the Batman Arkham games are basically extensions of the animated series. So it's sort of a pre-existing continuity. It's a pre-existing sensibility. So if you watch the animated series, it was like, this is a great sequel to that. Spider-Man, this is its own thing. And those opening hours, or just 30 minutes, fuck it, of just getting to know what it's like to swing and to fight and to move around New York, and you start to see what sorts of things you're going to get to do in the open world, but you're also starting to see, like, what's their version of Peter Parker like? What are the characters they've decided to put in this continuity where, you know, Peter has been Spider-Man for about 7 years in this continuity? What has happened? Where are we at? It is such a beautiful sense of discovery at the beginning of this game. And the great thing is, at least for me, Sean, that sense of discovery has not abated pretty much at all in the many hours I've spent with it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the game does such a good job of constantly introducing you to new kinds of activities. The story moves along and does, like, I think a good touchstone for talking about this game in terms of an open world game is Infamous Second Son, which had the same sort of, it has a very clear focus on one main story. It's not Witcher or Grand Theft Auto or Red Dead or a game like that where there's, you know, I feel like most open world games are like that where they have a bunch of different story threads that are going that will, like, kind of coalesce and then depart, and there's like two or three main missions you can play at most points in the game. Spider-Man is more, there is one main mission at any given point. Sometimes they do a cool thing where the main mission is, it won't unlock it for like a couple of minutes or something. It'll just be like, hey, just go swing around, do whatever you want, and then eventually the main mission will continue in a little bit. But yeah, the main mission is sort of like locks the story into place, so the time of day and the sort of like tone and aesthetic and atmosphere of the game and the music and the kinds of random crimes that populate in the world, all of those things shift as the story progresses, and it creates a very awesome, very different kind of sensation from most other open world games where you really feel like you are living inside of this story and living inside of Spider-Man's shoes over the course of what is, like, I think probably like a month or so of in-game time. There's some time skips. You know, you see Spider-Man like at dusk in New York City, at night, in the morning, and like when it shifts time and what it does with those time shifts all serve the story instead of there just being this like, well, I guess I've been Spider-Man for 3 years or something based on how this day-night cycle has been rapidly shifting around New York and, you know, like Spider-Man 2 or something, the old Spider-Man game. I really like this kind of very story-focused approach to open worlds that allow the developers to create all this sort of change and shift in the way the open world works over the course of the game. Because I feel like most open world games just never really try to go for that thing. Most open world games go for there's a bunch of different story threads you could all go do whenever you want. I really like this very story-focused approach. It's the same kind of thing I liked about Infamous.
Yeah, although at the same time, what really boggles my mind about the overall design of this game and what impresses me so much is that you're absolutely right. It has this main story that's the driving thread, and everything you do feels like it is this evolve, like it is persistent. The world, like if you're doing a mission at night, it's because the story left you there at night. It's not these arbitrary shifts between night and day. So you have this sense of continuity and focus to everything you're doing in the game. And yet it is also, it's got a ton of shit on the map. It is, there's 55 backpacks to find, and you've got all the Black Cat stuff to do, and you've got all the bases to go raid, and there's a ton of stuff. You know, and at first you might almost look at it and be like, oh my god, that looks like an Ubisoft map for a second. And then you realize the way they've tied it all together is that everything in the game is meant to make you feel like you're Spider-Man. So if you are going and doing a mission, it's because Spider-Man has a thing to do right now. But if you're out in the world patrolling, there's all that stuff out there so that it feels like you're swinging through the world both at random and with purpose, because there's a million things to go discover, because that's what it's like to be Peter Parker. If you're swinging on your way to go meet Aunt May for dinner, well, on the way there, there's going to be 3 car hijackings, and there's going to be somebody getting mugged, and there's going to be an old backpack that you can find, and you're going to find all this stuff along the way. And so what it's combining is like this sort of like old school open world multiplicity of design, like let's put all this stuff on the map, with this sort of post Witcher 3, let's focus in and make everything feel like a committed part of the world, a committed part of the experience of being this character. And it somehow threads that needle and does it all at once. I've never seen anything like that in an open world design, where it is both incredibly like vast in the amount of just little things on the map to do, and everything you do feels like this is just part of the story, because this is what Spider-Man would be doing.
Yeah, and it's there are a couple of things that I think that are really important about this game that make that work. One really small design choice that is so elegant that I think is a huge part of making that work is that you can just click in on the right thumbstick at any point and do a like pulse on the map, and it will pop up icons like in the world while you're swinging. That'll show you, oh, there's a collectible over here. There's this kind of mission over here. There's a crime happening over here. My main mission is off in the distance. I could go to that base. And so while you're swinging through the world towards whatever your like main objective is, you at any time you can very seamlessly take stock of and just like look, instead of having to stare at a mini map or like the worst option is having to pause the game and look at the full world map and like put icons over the place, which is like, you know, playing an old Assassin's Creed game, is you have to stop every 5 minutes and pause the map and scroll around and be like, oh, okay, this is the kind of side mission I want to do. I'll put a waypoint here and run over there. In Spider-Man, you're just, it's a constant seamless experience, and it's only if like you are looking for something very specific you want to do that you ever would have to need to open up the actual world map. Most of the time, I'm just swinging around, like looking, like going, collecting a backpack and see, oh, I can go do this thing also. And it makes it's seamless. And there's a flow and continuity of experience there that is unbroken and allows you to just, you know, have that thing that video games do if you just forget what time it is because I'm so focused on the objectives and so in the sort of flow of playing the game that I've completely lost track of like what is happening in the actual real world of like me sitting on this couch. I'm so absorbed into whatever I'm doing as Spider-Man because I never have to break that experience.
This is a game where literally hours have flown by without me noticing how much time has passed. That's pretty rare for me in a video game these days. I'm an adult, I'm conscious of time. But there have been moments where it's like, I check, you know, the time, you know, as I'm starting up the game, and it's like, oh, it's 4 o'clock, okay. And then I do a bunch of stuff, I just lose myself in it, and then I think at some point, like, I wonder what time it is. Time, that's a thing. And I'll check the clock again, I'm like, oh, it's 6. Oh, okay, I've played this game for 2 hours. And I just get this sense of, like, I've been on the most incredible fucking sugar high. Because this game is just, it's like an out-of-body experience. You go into it, and there's just so much to do, and it is all so insanely fun, and it is so fast-paced. I agree completely with what you said about the way the map system works and everything, because there feels like there's so little barrier between you choosing to do a thing and going to do it, or not even choosing to do a thing, just stumbling upon it. Because also, they've done a great job at, as much as possible, alighting things like loading screens, and when you go to start an activity, like long cutscenes in and out of that activity. Very frequently, you never have to stop moving to do a bunch of different things in the game. It's not until you get to some of the like higher level objectives on the map that there might be some little interruptions, and even then they're very quick. So it is just, it is a very unique thing for me, especially in a big open world, to feel like this constant sense of momentum and pulse to the proceedings, whereas I feel like Most open world games, if I binged them like I've been binging this one, I would just feel worn out and tired and like on my last legs by the end. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. And obviously, I think like the elephant in the room in this discussion, the thing that actually makes all that shit work is the traversal mechanics and the web swinging and just navigating the city of New York in Marvel Spider-Man is the most fun I've had moving in a video game. Like it's particularly of an open world game, you know, like obviously like platformers are about moving. And so that's kind of like a different thing, but just like with no objective, no aim in mind, no purpose to what I'm doing, just swinging in this game and just moving around the world is so fun and exciting and varied and dynamic. And it is everything that you want the web swinging in a Spider-Man game to be. It is because it's also way more than just the web swinging. It's your what you are doing when you're traversing the city is not just I'm throwing out a web line and swinging, then jumping, throwing out another web line. You're combining all these different kind of traversal mechanics from wall running to the point launch mechanic to web zipping to doing the just normal web swings into running up the side of a building and propelling yourself around it or running around the corner of a building and sort of like hooking around the corner to do a quick change or direction shift. There are so many little kind of movement mechanics in the game that you can chain together to really get this sense of mastery over the way that Spider-Man maneuvers around the city and put you where you want to be in this like really cool, dynamic, dramatic way that gives the player a huge amount of control in how they approach that.
There's a point like after an hour or two of playing this game and getting to know the traversal mechanics where I stop thinking I'm using a controller. It doesn't even feel like there's a controller in my hands. It feels like I am just thinking what to do with Spider-Man in the world, and I'm doing it. And it is both because the controls are very smart and very fluid and very intuitive, but it's also because what those controls represent and what you do with them is this incredible physics-based movement system where Spider-Man has weight and momentum, and when you attach to a wall and swing, you are like a pendulum at the end of a string with like actual weight and movement attached to that. And so you feel like such a physical presence in this world and a physical presence shooting your webs out. I completely agree. It's the best traversal mechanic I've ever seen. It feels like a Nintendo level of like platforming control polish put into a Western open world comic book game. And it's obviously no coincidence that Insomniac are the people who finally cracked the code on this because they've made platformers in the past, you know? Like, that's who you want doing this game, is someone who has cut their teeth on things like Ratchet and Clank, which is their big claim to fame before this, because it has that kind of, like, platforming polish to it. I was looking at the trophy list the other day, and I saw, as a trophy for Spider-Man to ride the subway 4 times. And I'm like, how can you ride the subway in Spider-Man? What the hell? And I spent like 2 hours in the game. Like, I kept coming back in my head. I'm like, I wonder what that refers to. And I even did this whole thing where I went like down near the ground and just swung around down near the ground. I'm like, where's a subway entrance? I wonder what I do to get on the subway. And then I finally realized, oh, there's a fast travel mechanic in this game. And that's what the subway is. You just have to fast travel 4 times and you get the trophy. And I'm like, why would you ever put a fast travel system in this game? Why would you ever make a trophy around it? Because the last thing I would ever want to do in Spider-Man on PS4 is fast travel, because that takes away the best part of the fucking game.
Yeah, like, I love, because I feel like the point of the fast travel system is to make a point, to be like, it exists so that you can use it, and the fact that you could use it means it's like your choice not to use it is so intentional. It makes you really appreciate the traversal system of the game that's like fucking fast travel, because I don't think there's a single person who's playing this game that's like, well, thank God there's a fast travel system in this game. Everybody's like, why would I ever fast travel, other than, you know, the little graphics in the loading screen of Spider-Man hanging out on the subway are very funny.
Yes.
And so I appreciate that, and like I like that. I find the idea of the trophy very amusing, and I look forward to eventually remembering to do that and just fast traveling a bunch and seeing like the goofy graphics that they put into the loading screen. But other than that, it's all about just being like, fuck fast travel, man. I just want to swing.
It's so good. And in addition to the swinging, because I think this is so closely tied, I expected the traversal to be good. I don't know if I expected to be as good as it is, because until you play it, you could never expect something that fun. The combat in this game is sublime. It is easily the biggest surprise about this game to me, because no one has ever come close to nailing Spider-Man combat. Like, that's almost always the biggest fall down of Spider-Man games in the past. I mean, you've played more of them than I have. Would you say that's the case?
Oh, absolutely. There's no Spider-Man game that has good combat. There are, like, Web of Shadows has the best combat out of any of them, and it's, like, it's okay for about, like, 5 hours in what is, like, a 20-hour long open world game. It's like, that was the best they ever got. Like, Spider-Man 2, which is the sort of, you know, the Spider-Man game that people hold up because it had, that was the one that cracked the swinging for the first time, and swinging that game is really good, especially very impressive for its time, but the combat in that game is fucking garbage. Like, it is just mid-2000s licensed tier, like, B-tier game, the action, like, third-person character action combat. It's so basic and just sort of dull that, yes, every other Spider-Man game has fallen down hard on the combat, and the best ones are the ones that basically, like, don't even involve much combat at all, like the old, like, Neversoft 2000 Spider-Man game. That's like, there is combat in that game, but that game is not about the combat. It's much more of, like, sort of an action platformer. But yes, I am with you 100%. The thing that is most surprising and most impressive about Marvel Spider-Man, the Insomniac Spider-Man game, I like that they put Marvel Spider-Man is the technical full title, so you can call it that and people know what the fuck you're talking about, instead of saying, like, the best part about Spider-Man, which you could be talking about 100 different things if you just say that. But the best part about Marvel Spider-Man, in terms of the most surprising element of it, is the combat design is just immaculate. It is not Arkham Combat, and I have seen a lot of people, both, like, before the game's release and very confusingly to me after the game's release, of people, some, like, reviewers and stuff playing the game, calling it Arkham Combat. It's like, this is not Arkham Combat. Like, there are obviously some similarities in that any third-person action game with a character that does not have, like, a sword is going to have some similarities to Arkham Combat. There's, like, a guy jumping around fucking punching people in the face is a part of the combat system. But there's no counter. And that's, like, the fact that there is no counter move, the closest you get is the perfect dodge, and even that's not really a counter attack. That's like, there's no, you can't make Arkham comparisons there. Because Arkham combat systems need two things. It needs the rhythmic, normal melee attack, and it needs the counter. And that's the two things. Those are the two core pillars of the Arkham combat system, and Marvel Spider-Man really doesn't have either of them. Because also the normal attacks do not have the rhythmic buildup of, like, the combo thing that the Arkham games have. It has technically a combo meter, but it operates in such a different way. And the combat has a lot more similarities to other sort of, like, third-person action games, like a Devil May Cry or something like that. It also has the reliance upon gadgets that is obviously a big Insomniac thing. That's, like, one of the big things for Ratchet and Clank is all the crazy different weapons you can make in those games. And this has that and integrates them so fully. And it is just this really full presentation of what Spider-Man combat is and should be like. Like, if you read a Spider-Man comic, like, you know, all the Spider-Man comics I'm reading right now, in those comics, the way you picture Spider-Man fighting, like, in between these sort of action panels is exactly what he's doing in this game. It is, he's so fluid and dynamic and jumping all over the place and quipping and firing webs off. The way the webs work in the combat is just incredible and something that no Spider-Man combat has ever even gotten close to doing when Insomniac does, with the way the webbing interacts with the enemies, and then you can tie them up and, like, throw them and stick them to walls and stuff like that, or, like, just stick them to the ground. One of my favorite things to do in this combat system is to spam my web shooters and web a dude up, like, rush over to them, launch them up into the air, and then if you hold down triangle, you web them and then slam them into the ground, and then they just stick to the ground. And there's something about that element of you sticking people and webbing people up, and like you, when you leave a combat encounter, there are just random criminals webbed up to the sides of, like, lampposts and, like, webbed to the sides of cars and on the, like, the sidewalk and up in, like, a ceiling. And with you, that sort of how you leave a crime scene once Spider-Man has dealt with it basically looks like a panel from a comic book. And it's like Spider-Man has been here. This isn't Batman or whoever, or like Daredevil that just runs in and beats the crap out of people and runs away. Spider-Man relies way more upon webbing people up and then leaving them kind of hanging there. And there's something so sort of specific and kind of superheroic about that I kind of avoid just beating the shit out of people.
Uh-huh.
And rather look for those ways that I can kind of incapacitate them, because that feels like what Spider-Man does.
this game has easily, to me, easily the most fun third-person combat I've ever encountered in a video game. Like, not even a question in my mind. I'm not including, like, a fighting game like Smash Bros. Or something. Just like a you know, third-person, over-the-shoulder, anything where you're going out and using a sword or a gun or whatever it is. I have had so much fun. There are moments, especially in some of, like, the base takedown missions and stuff, where they just throw waves upon waves of guys at you, where I'm forgetting to breathe, because there are so many things to do, there's so many ways to approach any combat encounter, and you feel like Spider-Man. You have all these powers, you feel like a superhero, and it is such an incredibly fun challenge. It engages every part of your brain. It really makes you think. It engages your reaction time on the controller. It is such a ludicrous amount of fun. And the thing that makes it extra stupid to compare this to Arkham is, I mean, we both love the Batman Arkham system. This is not an indictment of, like, that fighting system. It's brilliant, and I think its time has passed, but it was very influential, obviously. But the Batman Arkham system is more like a fighting game. It is a very kind of limited set of moves that you can do, and kind of, you know, combat encounters tend to be very similar. They'll have different kind of stages and levels to them, but, you know, you have a couple of, you know, you have a punch, and you have a heavy move, and you have your counter, and you have the rhythm, and you get into it, and it's all about being in the rhythm and the flow of it. That's not what Spider-Man is like. Spider-Man, again, it's multiplicity. It's let's give you a ton of shit. You could give me the exact same combat scenario 5 times in a row in Spider-Man, and it would not feel repetitive to me, because I would do it 5 completely different ways, because you have so many gadgets at your disposal. You have so many ways to use your webs. Like, the basic action of going up to a guy and using the square button and punching them 4 times and knocking them out, I barely remember to do that most of the time, because there are so many other ways to approach things. There are so many ways to just, if your goal is, I'm going to web people to walls, there are so many ways that you could web people to walls. It is an incredible amount of fun. And I think another key piece of it is that they've modulated the challenge just right. Because at the start, I found this game really hard. I was dying a lot. Like, I kept, like, trying to execute things, and I wasn't doing it quite right. And I'm playing on the default difficulty. I think it's Amazing is the main one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, this game's pretty hard. And I realized why it is hard is that once you get into the flow of things and the game really starts giving you stuff, you have so many options. You have so many things you could do. The only way to not make you feel insanely overpowered in this game is to throw a truly ridiculous amount of enemies at you in these big combat encounters, because otherwise it would just feel like a walk in the park. You would just do a couple of webs off and they would all be stuck to walls and that would be the end of it. And actually, I'm at a point in the game where, like, little crimes on the street, that's pretty much what I'm doing, is I run down and I'm like, web, switch to this, web, all right, you're all stuck to the wall, and I'm leaving before the cops are even there to thank me, you know? But when you get into the heavier stuff, they keep ratcheting the challenge and the amount of guys up and the things to throw at you, and it's so smart. They've just got it all calibrated so well. It makes such a beautiful transition also between the stealth mechanics, where it's sort of, that's actually the most similar to Arkham to me, is like they have things that kind of feel like Predator maps, but even then, ultimately, it's going to send you into the flow of combat. This is not a stealth game, and it doesn't want to be a stealth game. But when it has those little, like, flirtations with stealth, it's also very fun. And the reason I was connecting this to the traversal mechanics earlier is that it all feels so of a piece, because the traversal winds up being a big part of the combat too, and you can go in and out of, oh, I'm webbing around the city, I'm going to jump down and get these guys, and in the middle of webbing, I might hit my triangle and pull myself down to one of the enemies, and then I'm going to lift them up into the air and swing them around and hit 3 other enemies along the way, and then once I've knocked them all out, I'm going to go right back into swinging around the city. It doesn't feel like you go from web-swinging mode to combat mode to other kinds of modes. You're just Spider-Man. You're just Spider-Man in the game doing all these things. And it is such a unified vision of a video game, mechanically as well as narratively and aesthetically, which we'll talk about later and more next week, that it really just blows my mind.
Yeah, it's something I talked about. I think it was around E3 when they released that big, or they did that big live stream right after E3 of the Insomniac devs playing through the demo they showed off on the show floor and kind of talking through the game. And I think I watched that and talked about on the podcast that what it looked like to me, and now that I played the game, I can say for sure 100% they have nailed this, that they have done that no other Spider-Man game has managed to do that is incredibly difficult, is that Spider-Man is like Sonic the Hedgehog or some other characters that are very hard to do in 3D. moves at two very different kinds of speeds. And Spider-Man is swinging down the city at, like, rapid speeds, and particularly, like, at the point I'm at with the game and the upgrades I have and the, you know, skill I've developed at web swinging, I can fucking book down that city at this point. And so you can move at those extremely fast speeds, but then also, obviously, you need to be able to slow down and deal with a combat encounter and you know, just sort of in a more enclosed area. And you can't be, like, webbing off at, like, 60 miles an hour because there's no way you can manage a combat at that speed. And so Spider-Man needs to stop and slow down and walk around, and he needs to be able to swing really fast. And no other Spider-Man game has ever reconciled those two things. They either do the, like, really fast web swinging really well, like Web of Shadows in Spider-Man 2, and the slow stuff is kind of, like, acceptable at its best, or it's like that Neversoft game in where there is no high-speed stuff, and it's all enclosed sort of, like, linear levels, and that action is fine for, like, a character platformer kind of game. But you don't get, like, the sense of the, like, majesty and speed and acceleration of Spider-Man, and Insomniac is the first developer to take this character and meld both of those things together. And as you said, it there's something so holistic about the representation of the character. And this is true across, like, everything in the narrative as well. But just in terms of the game design, like, one of the things in the combat that I needed to sort of get used to for it to click for me, because I'm playing on the spectacular difficulty, which is the hardest one you can play at the beginning of the game. And the beginning of the game is fucking hard on that difficulty. Holy shit, that Kingpin section is difficult when, you know, you're playing the game for the first time, you don't know how it works. And the thing I needed to figure out is you have to be so mobile during combat. Yes. You have to be jumping and dodging around and leaping out of the way and sometimes, like, doing little web zips and stuff. And sort of, like, you never stand still as Spider-Man. You're never stopped. You're never, like, locked into one combo. I feel like I'm usually doing, like, three attacks on a guy as, like, my max. And then once I've done that, I need to be, like, I can't be spending this much time on one enemy. I need to hop around and focus on something else. And you're so sort of, like, manic and all over the place when you get, like, a handle of how you need to approach those combat encounters, that feels like Spider-Man. And it feels like it's the same Spider-Man that is web-zipping like crazy around the city and swinging and, like, jumping off of a web line and running off the side of the wall and spinning around and diving deep down. And all those kinds of movements he does in the web-swinging feels like the same kinds of movements just sort of scaled down to a local kind of, like, combat encounter in the combat sections. And so all that design of the character feels, it's so contiguous between these various different, like, really well-developed sort of mechanical systems that Insomniac has made. They don't, even while I can, you know technically these are very isolated in some ways for, like, game design reasons, it never feels like they're isolated. They feel like they're completely fluid and that you're transitioning from combat to swinging and you're never breaking the sort of sense of character and never feel like, okay, I'm in combat mode, now I'm in swinging mode, which is one thing I think that a criticism I would have of the Arkham games is that those games very much feel like I'm in traversal mode, now I'm in combat mode, now I'm in stealth mode, now I'm in puzzle mode, now I'm in combat mode, and all those things are very blocked off from one another most of the time. There's a little bit of flow between stealth and combat, but not very much. In Spider-Man, all that stuff sort of flows together and mixes together and feels seamless.
Oh, absolutely. You know what the combat, like, when I'm fully into it, it reminds me of is the Spectacular Spider-Man cartoon series that we both love that aired on Disney? Was it Disney back in the day?
I think it was Disney XD, yeah.
Yeah, and it's the one that got canceled after Marvel. Was it? It might not have been Disney, because it was canceled after Marvel. Disney bought Marvel, so I don't know what the whole thing was. But we loved that series, and one of the reasons I loved it, and now that I say this, I know I'm going to go bust out the Blu-ray set and watch it again, because I have to, is all the fight scenes in that series did such a good job at making Spider-Man feel fast and acrobatic, but also with weight and physical movement behind him. It's because they used this very lean art style that allowed them on a TV budget to make it feel like they were doing the most insane action sequences you'd ever seen. And it feels like I'm playing that, like a really good, dedicated representation of what this, you know, superhero who his whole defining thing is he's like a spider. He's very acrobatic and he can leap around and he has all these, you know, things that are actually pretty hard to represent in a live action film. Like the Sam Raimi films do it pretty well. I think Spider-Man Homecoming did it pretty well, but there's only so far you can push when you have an actual human being on screen. This is that level of like, okay, this is like a comic book. This is like a cartoon series. The only limit is your imagination. And it feels like it is engaging that imagination at every turn.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the other things I want to note about the combat is it just evidence of how good the combat is and how much I enjoy it is that I like actively don't use the suit power abilities that you have in the game because I feel like I'm robbing myself of a combat experience if I use them because they're so powerful. And it's like, they're good. It's good that they're there because, like, you know, if you're someone that isn't super into the combat or, like, you know, you're not great at it or something, you have this, like, sort of, like, extra ability to fall back on, like, the Web Blossom or something if things get really tough, because they can get very tough in this game for sure. But I'm at this point where the one I use is the Hollow Decoy one that's in the Scarlet Spire suit because it's the least powerful. And it's also very funny, and I like popping it sometimes because it's very goofy. And they've recorded a bunch of different lines for the, like, fake hologram Spider-Mans to say. That's very good. But, like, I played for a little bit. I used the Web Blossom ability you get with the classic suit. And then eventually I was like, I don't want to do this anymore because every time I do it, I feel kind of bummed out because it's such a lame way to finish this combat encounter. Even if I'm getting my ass kicked, I still want that, like, sort of edge of the seat. Like, no, I need to find some way to sort of, like, get around this rocket and get around that guy and get some distance and figure out how I'm going to solve the situation and not lean on this, like, get out of jail free button that some of those powers feel like.
Yeah, I reached that point earlier today where I'd actually been using Web Blossom as kind of my default. Because it is super useful, but I'm also pretty good at the game at this point, and I want to be challenged more. So I've switched it over to some. I'm kind of experimenting with other ones, and I am excited. At some point, I'm going to have to go back and play this game again on spectacular difficulty. And it is rare that I'm excited to replay this game at some point on a higher difficulty. But this is definitely one where I want to have the challenge at some point. Although again, the main default difficulty is no slouch. It's going to give you a good solid challenge. So, and there is a level easier than that too, which again, difficulty levels are good. We approve of
them
here on the Weekly Stuff Podcast. Yes.
God, that's something to make a brief detour, but I think it is still kind of relevant of it, of when the reviews came out for this game, it just reminded me of something, because it was in a number of different reviews that drives me crazy, is when reviewers talk about, like, and like the combat was good, but then eventually I felt like it wasn't pushing me hard enough, and I was like, well, what about the difficulty options? And no reviewers ever, I didn't read a single fucking review of the game that talked about difficulty options at all, especially even in relation to that issue. And it was always just like, why do game critics never even address it? Like, I'm not saying you have to play the game on all the difficulties, but at least address the fact that they exist, because I think, like, this game is so much fun when you are, like, pushed up against the wall and you really have to make use of your abilities, that if you're someone that wants that experience, I would recommend playing on Spectacular. Maybe do Amazing for, like, the first mission so that, like, you can kind of get your head around the combat system because you can switch it whenever you want. But after that, and, like, if you want a, like, sort of richer but also, like, kind of more slightly more brutal experience, I highly recommend bumping it up to Spectacular because it is such a fun way to play the game. They also, one thing I think they do is they add more enemies to most of the encounters.
Oh,
it's not just that it's not just that they do more damage or have more health. There's just more of them because some of the encounters in the game, there are a lot of fucking people on screen at one time. It's like, Jesus Christ, there are a lot of these dudes. And I'm always sort of flabbergasted when I swing into a random crime and it's like, I heard on the radio that it's like, oh, there's a mugging in Central Park, and I swing in, it's like, there's like 12 guys here. How many people do you need to mug a random person, guys? Like, holy shit.
That kind of blows me away because there's already, I already have those moments on the Amazing difficulty regularly where I'll swing in and I'm like, that's more than I was expecting. I'm going to back up for a second and rethink my strategy here, you know?
Yeah, it's like, do all 15 of you really want to be standing on this one rooftop? That just doesn't seem safe.
I also love it with the mugging ones. It's like, maybe this guy has $50 in his wallet. Are you splitting it 15 ways? What's the take home of this mugging for all of you? It's great.
Yeah.
It's great that the game just leaves logic behind in those moments because it's a video game. You got to do that sometimes. Yeah. So, backing up to one thing you said, you mentioned Sonic the Hedgehog. I totally agree because this game, whether you're doing combat or you're doing stealth or you're doing traversal or even when you're doing some of the weird puzzle solving in the game, there is a sense of momentum to what you are doing in this game. And momentum does not mean fast, 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 fast all the time. but it means that you feel like there's an active pulse to everything you are doing. There is a wave carrying you forward through everything. That's what a good Sonic the Hedgehog game does in 2D, for instance, and I think it's what this game masters all over the place, and it is such an impressive thing, because momentum is really hard to come by, especially in a complicated, multifaceted 3D open-world game like this, and I've certainly never seen an open-world game that feels like it has this kind of momentum, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And that is like the secret sauce that makes the web-swinging work, is that it's not just like a go-fast button. Because actually, especially early on, like it feels very tricky when you're learning the system mm-hmm. to actually get going fast, because you have to chain together different kinds of moves and kind of like practice the timing of web swinging to actually build up a sense of momentum. Because you can, you know, start web swinging and go like pretty slowly if you don't know, like, oh, I kind of need to web zip here and like dive bomb down and get closer to the street and get kind of like a longer swing going. You have to learn the sort of ins and outs, and it is very much about that kind of building up momentum and sort of building up a velocity and then kind of like losing it a little bit and then like swinging around a corner. It's all about managing that sense of acceleration and momentum to get where you want to go.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to cut us off within 10 minutes here for this episode, but we're going to talk about this game in excruciating, spoiler-filled detail next week. But for now, for this first impressions, are there any other things you want to hit while we're on the topic?
I just wanted to, you know, we'll talk about this element a lot more next time, because it's a lot of the main story stuff, it ties into this. But I just want to say how much I love and appreciate how much Peter Parker is in this game, and that it's like, you know, it's not just, you're not just Spider-Man all the time, which is every other fucking Spider-Man game ever. And it's also, it's one of the things I really wish the Arkham games had done more of, is let's see the full experience of this character. Because, you know, particularly for Spider-Man, you need as much Peter Parker as you need Spider-Man to make a good Spider-Man story. You can't just have him be Spider-Man all the time. That's like, I'm reading these comic books, and whenever there's an issue where he's never Peter Parker, it's easily like one of the worst issues I've read in like dozens. It's like, fucking, how did they, you know, how would you write this issue? How do you not fall back onto the human drama of Peter and his supporting cast? And this game has a lot of Peter. Obviously, you're playing Spider-Man for most of the main video game stuff, but you have sections where you're playing as Peter. You have little science puzzles, and you do little spectrograph things, which are fun for me because
I've already got all of them.
Yeah, I did those in a physics class called Stars and Galaxies I took, of like obviously a slightly more complicated real world version of that, but that is like a actual science thing for identifying substances, and so that's fun. And just like, you get that sense of the experience of Peter and having to manage all these different like expectations from different people, and his relationships with Aunt May and Mary Jane, and then and Yuri Watanabe, and then his scientist stuff. All that stuff is expressed in the game and is not just sort of like, oh, here's one little side quest where we kind of like, you know, reference it or do it a little bit. Like Arkham Knight had the one side quest where you were Bruce Wayne for like 5 minutes or something. I think that was like the Hush stuff. This is like, no, it's a part of the full continuity of this character and this game, this experience, and this the story that they want to tell. And it's the kind of thing that no superhero game I've ever played has done. No superhero game has ever actually done that and told that kind of story. They always tell the big, dumb action movie story. And then obviously, like the Arkham games, Batman has, enough of like the psychological drama and character stuff within his alter ego that it works for those. But Batman is basically the only superhero that works for. And all the other ones, you need to have the human there to have it function, even on like a basic dramatic level. And Insomniac is finally the developer to say, fucking, this is how you have to do this stuff, and they have done it.
Yeah. It never bothered me in the Batman games, because Bruce Wayne is not the character. Batman is the character. Batman is his primary identity. To me, like, this is a fundamental thing about the character. Bruce Wayne is not a person. Bruce Wayne is a mask. It is a facade. He is at his truest self when he's in the cowl, and I think the Batman games actually exploit that very well, and they get away with it. But for most superheroes, you couldn't get away with that, and especially for Spider-Man, you have to have a sense of the duality and of the human being inside that costume, and you get such a sense of it. Because it's not just the moments where you go play as Peter or see a cutscene, it's just while he's webbing around the city and he gets a call from Aunt May or a call from Mary Jane or someone else. He's Peter Parker within that suit. He is the person, and the person has a life and an existence that is out there in the world, in the continuity. It is a sense of the self that you get while playing, even if you're webbing around doing crazy stuff. And I think that is, it's a magic trick, because you don't play a Spider-Man game to play as Peter Parker walking around getting coffee, but you do play a Spider-Man game because Peter Parker is Spider-Man, so you have to get him in there in a sense that feels real. And I think they've done that extraordinarily well. I agree. And we should also just, we'll talk about all the voice acting because it's great, but Yuri Lowenthal, he is Kevin Conroy as Batman level good as this character. He is amazingly good. And there have been plenty of good Peter Parkers and Spider-Mans, but holy crap, he fits this role like a glove. It is insane. I am constantly kind of blown away by how funny he is, how good the writing for him is. I mean, and I've liked Yuri Lowenthal before. This is not like a new actor. He's always great. But I don't think you could ask for a better Peter Parker or Spider-Man.
Yeah, he's great. Then an element of that also is their choice to make him the older Peter Parker. Mm-hmm. That's a bit more sort of like with how Peter Parker is in more modern Marvel comics. And so there's he has a very different feel than the Spider-Man we get in like non-comic book media all the time, which is always the young, inexperienced high school Spider-Man or maybe into college. And you never get the older Spider-Man that's more experienced, that, you know, has all these different kind of villains and supporting characters. I love that they're pulling in characters from more modern comic stuff, partially because I haven't read most of those comics. So it's interesting and surprising for me as a Spider-Man fan because I haven't seen that stuff yet. So like Mr. Negative and Captain Watanabe are characters I'm vaguely familiar with, like in the ether of Spider-Man, but have never had direct experience with. So I think all those little choices in how you adapt the character are so smart and give this game a really striking sense of its own identity as a piece of Spider-Man media that is very different from what you'll get if you watch any of the movies or any of the cartoon series.
Absolutely. And my other favorite detail about Yuri Lowenthal playing this character is that one of the people he talks to most in the game is a character named Yuri Watanabe. And I wonder what that was like in the recording booth of he is constantly saying the name Yuri. His own name is Yuri. And I have to imagine that was just hella confusing for everyone in the booth trying to like coordinate things at certain times.
Because it's since it's not an American name, it's not a common name to hear in any sort of American media. And the Yuris, the two Yuris are Yuris from totally different cultures that the name Yuri comes from. And so I love that it's just like, there's some weird sort of cross-cultural thing that happened in Marvel Spider-Man. It's an American game with like an Eastern European Yuri and then a Japanese Yuriko that is like abbreviated to Yuri. And it's like, I don't know how all that works, but it is something that is very funny to me.
I also want to give a brief shout out to, I think their reimagining of Mary Jane is phenomenal. Laura Bailey is a great Mary Jane. They've kind of turned her into a Lois Lane-esque figure, and I think it works very, very well. Is there a precedent for this in modern comics?
No, in terms of the reporter thing, as far as I know. Again, I haven't read like the most recent sort of like the Dan Slott stuff. I haven't seen, so I don't know what they do with the character like post the continuity shift. But what it reminds me of is like, what if Ultimate Spider-Man Mary Jane had grown up? Because especially in some of the backpack collectibles, in the sense of like the relationship they had in high school that you get a sense of, it sounds like they're pulling a lot from Ultimate Spider-Man in that. And I can, while, you know, she's not ever specifically a reporter in that continuity, that's kind of what it feels like they're kind of pulling from, is what if this character grew up and like, how would she go out into the world? Because she doesn't feel like she would be a model or an actress or, you know, like runs a bar or whatever, like other Mary Janes from other continuities have done. So yeah, there's no direct precedence, but it makes sense for me.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think it's one of the best presentations of that character and relationship. Like there are like Witcher 3 level good scenes between the two of them in this game where it's like, they are sketching such a full human relationship in these moments. And I was not expecting that. I didn't need that going in to enjoy a Spider-Man game, but it's so much better for it. And also, this isn't a spoiler that he's in the game. It was in the E3 demo. Miles Morales. I cried at a scene with him today, and it's not even a sad scene. I love it.
I haven't gotten to a lot of stuff with Miles yet. I've only seen him in a couple of scenes, so that's. I think I'm like about to get a lot more of him where I'm at in the game.
Yeah. I said this on Twitter today, and we'll talk about it more next week. My hope is that the sequel is a Miles Morales Spider-Man game, because I think...
Of course, I mean, my guess is it's going to be both of them. I think it'd be, that has to be what they do, right? And they name it Marvel Spider-Man, and there you go, it's Miles and it's Peter.
All right, well, we'll see. Any other comments you want to make about this fantastic game before we break for tonight?
I just saw earlier today before we started recording that it apparently the European or like the UK sales came in because video games are weird and we only ever get to hear about the UK stuff. And if going by the UK sales chart, Marvel Spider-Man is currently the fastest selling video game of this year. It beat out Far Cry 5, which had held that title for new game releases here. That's the fastest selling. And it's only available on the PlayStation 4. And that's fucking crazy that it's selling that much.
Oh, this game is going to sell a loot. This could be the highest selling PS4 game or exclusive.
Yeah, it has sold twice what God of War sold in the equivalent amount of time. And God of War sold like 3+ million copies, I think. So yeah. In that time span. So
this is
a big game. This is gonna fucking make some waves, I think.
Absolutely, it's such a coup that PS4 and Sony got this. But also, this wasn't going to be this game anywhere else because this is so clearly a Sony game. This is in their current tradition that they are building of we are making big, ambitious, unique games, and we are giving developers all the time and money in the world to do it because we can, and they're going to come out hyper-polished and hyper, unique and singular. And again, I have to stress, I think the two best games I've played this year so far came out the same week, exclusive to PS4. The PlayStation is in an incredible place right now for video games.
Absolutely, yeah. It's been the past couple of years, this one including for PlayStation, has been just absurd in terms of the exclusives they have, which is the only reason, of course, why they can get away with the other bullshit in terms of like the service stuff. Yes. That's going on the console. But holy shit, if you want to play video games, like, you probably should have a PlayStation. Also, like, while I'm thinking about it, I'm looking at my beautiful PlayStation 4 Pro. We'll talk about it in more detail next time. But God, Jesus fucking Christ, is this game beautiful, Jonathan. Like, holy shit. In terms of, like, realistic representations of characters and, like, environments, this is the best-looking game I've played.
Yeah.
Like, it's especially as someone who's been to New York City a couple of times now. So I have, like, I'm not, like, a resident of New York City, but I have, like, enough of familiarity with the city to, like, I was able to find generally where the hotel I've stayed at in New York was. In that, it looks very different in the game, but, like, I could kind of navigate the city that way. It's just unbelievable the way this game looks. And yeah. And there are moments where I am, like, basically my mouth is just agape with how beautiful the lighting and the character models and the texture and the detail that's in every single Spider-Man outfit in this game is just, I can't believe that is running like a solid 30 frames per second on the PlayStation, because there are no frame rate drops. I have not seen it hitch fucking once. It is so solid and smooth, and it is utterly gorgeous.
Yeah, I have been very impressed by the graphics, but not that impressed. Not as impressed as you are, I should say. It is an unquestionably beautiful game. But I am rocking a 1080p TV. You've got your nice new 4K HDR TV. Does that play into it a little bit for you, do you think? Just it uses that...
Probably. I mean, this is the only game I've played on my PS4 Pro because it's the only... Nothing. There is no other game on this system right now because it has to basically like reformat the hard drive if you switch the PlayStations it's in. So it is. I have not touched anything else in 4K. I played a little bit of HDR because normal PS4s can do HDR. So I've seen what that like Hitman looks like and it's very cool. But yeah, so that might be contributing it to it. But I also just think There's some technical stuff. I would highly recommend people watch the Digital Foundry video. It's like a 20-minute video. It's really well done going into some of the stuff they do for this game because the magic tricks they pull in being able to make a giant Manhattan representation that is this detailed, because it's not just big block, rectangle block buildings, that like most Spider-Man games are, because you have to move so fast through it and load the scenery so quickly. This is like GTA levels of density. There's huge amounts of traffic and pedestrians on the street. There's so much going on in the city that it is that kind of thing we're talking about with like the swinging and the combat, that it nails both the like big picture super fast stuff, but then also if you sort of, I recommend like dropping down to the street and kind of smelling the roses for a second, because it is packed with so much love and care and attention to detail and technical artistry and wizardry in making this game work. I think it's utterly beautiful to me.
Absolutely. Last question before we break for today, Sean.
Yes.
The costumes.
Yes.
The main costume in the game is terrible. I don't like the big white spider thing. But right,
I've come to actually really appreciate the advanced suit. Okay. There's something about it that works for me.
I've barely used it because as they give you the nice classic suit also, and I just put that on immediately, and it's been my default. But putting that debate aside for a second, what is your favorite of the extra costumes to use so far?
Honestly, I've mostly been sticking to the advanced suit because since they contextualize it in the story, it feels weird to me to be out of it for too long. And so specifically for any cutscene, like I love the fact that you are wearing whatever suit you are in 100% of the time. So the cutscenes are whatever suit you're wearing. But I can't, I physically am incapable of advancing the story wearing anything other than the like Insomniac specific suit until a second playthrough. But I think this will be something we talk about more once I actually have seen all the costumes, because I think the selection so far has been not exactly what I would have expected. There are some costumes in there that I love and some that I'm like, I don't know if you needed to include this. But I love the Scarlet Spider outfit, the Ben Reilly one. It's good because it is very clearly Spider-Man, but it goes for a very different kind of look. And I like that. I like the... There's a delicate balance for an alternate Spider-Man costume of that. It needs to look like Spider-Man, but it needs to look different enough that I'd feel like I'm not just playing, you know, a slightly reshaded version of the normal costume. And I think that one's just really good.
Nice. I have been switching costumes all the time. I go into story missions generally with the classic suit that I've kind of designated as my default. Although there are times where, like, I do headcanon things of, like, it's nighttime and Spider-Man is infiltrating like Oscorp or something, so I'm like, I'm gonna put on a cool black suit and like be kind of stealthy with it. But I've been having fun, like especially when I'm swinging around at night. I love the negative suit. I think it's really cool. I've been wearing that one a lot in when it's nighttime scenes. My two favorites I actually don't want to spoil because they're the ones you get for getting all the backpacks and completing all the Black Cat stuff. And those two,
yeah,
I've been using in a lot of different scenarios. The one you get for the backpacks comes really in handy in a scene in the main story set at a costume party. And I fucking loved wearing it through that. But I think it's I love them all, and I'm excited. Obviously, there's more to unlock because I haven't gotten to the max level, and I'm excited to see what else they have because it's a blast.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of thing I've always wanted superhero games to do, is more like fully integrate the alternate costume things. It's always something like one of the weaker parts of the Arkham games is how that stuff has to be like was distributed across like different pre-order bonuses and shit, and it wasn't until like months after the release of the game that you could just be like, I just want to play as cool 70s Batman or whatever, like let me just have all that shit. I like that all that is just in the game and you unlock them through the story and they have like different functionalities associated with them. It's very smart of them to divorce the suit power from the suit, and so you yes. can play with whatever suit you want and use whatever ability you want. You just kind of unlock them at the same time and they're themed together. But yeah, like I think it's a really smart addition. I just like personally have a hard time avoiding the like narrative canon thing on my first playthrough of like I've got the big white logo on my big giant PS4 Pro that I spend a lot of money on, so I have to wear the big white spider. And there's something about it I like. He's very easy to spot in the city when it's like there's a big white thing on him. I can see him very quickly. That's Spider-Man right there. He's got a big dumb white spider on him and he's cool.
Well, maybe I'll play with that more. All right, Sean, we're not going to go away. We're going to talk about Spider-Man 3 and that episode will come out at some point, but we're going to call it an episode, and I totally made the right call deciding to split these episodes up. But anyway, we're going to go talk more Spider-Man. We're going to go play more Spider-Man. We might just lose our minds and go jump off a building in a Spider-Man costume and die, and there won't be another episode of the Weekly Stuff podcast. I don't know. We'll see you guys next time.
Enough said.